Thank you for joining us, and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. Please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And if you can't listen live, go to our website at answers.network and browse through a variety of heartfelt topics. What I'd really like you to do when you do that is forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is one powerful way that we together can make a positive difference in the world. Now, our guest today, Laura Davis, is a six-time best-selling author. Her books include The Courage to Heal and I Thought We'd Never Speak Again. And they've been translated into 11 languages and have sold 1.8 million copies. Laura leads writing workshops in the U.S. and internationally that focus on writing as a tool for healing and transformation. In her 30-plus year career as an author, Laura has written 7 nonfiction books that have changed people's lives. The Courage to Heal paved the way for hundreds of thousands to heal from the trauma of sexual abuse. Her new book is a memoir about the tumultuous twists and turns of mother-daughter love, titled The Burning Light of Two Stars. Now, this riveting memoir examines the endurance of mother-daughter love, how memory, it protects us, or sometimes it can betray us, and the determination it takes to fulfill a promise when ghosts from the past come knocking. Laura, welcome to Answers Network.
Thank you, Alan. Such a pleasure to be here.
And well, it is my pleasure. And as we were talking about a little bit before we went on the air, this is a subject that I think everybody is dealing with something, with someone. And I know that when I've spoken to people about the show coming up, that's what people said. And it wasn't necessarily always a mother-daughter, but there was somebody that they were estranged from, and it was still affecting them. But what I'd like to do is, rather than go into questions as I normally would, I'd like to ask you to read us a little bit as to what you believe introduces this book and what it's about for you.
Okay, I'd love to do that. And all you really need, this is when you write a book, or a novel, or watch a movie, there's always something called the inciting incident. And that's like the event that kicks the whole story into motion. And that's what this is in this memoir. It's called The Call. And the only thing you really need to know that happened right before this is I've just had a ritual in my backyard. I had a fire pit and I carried this binder from Stanford Cancer Center, and it had all the notes from a year of breast cancer treatment. And I've just been told that I have a good prognosis, that I'm healed, and I'm going to burn this notebook and everything in it because I want a fresh start and I want to just relax and have no toxic surprises. So that goes immediately before this moment.
All right.
Okay. 2 hours after my ceremony, I tasted my homemade tomato sauce simmering on the stove, added basil and oregano, a generous pinch of salt, a splash of red wine. Karen was picking up the kids on her way home from teaching reading at Watsonville High. They'd be home in half an hour. I was about to drop a handful of spaghetti into a pot of boiling water when the phone rang. It was my mother in New Jersey. We were due for a call. We hadn't spoken in several weeks. Cradling the phone between my neck and shoulder, I dropped the pasta into the pot, stirred to separate the strands. My glasses fogged with steam. I imagined her smoking parliaments, curled up with an Afghan on the couch in the den. She'd probably just gotten home from her poetry class or her Shakespeare class or her course in miracles study group. I could never track her schedule. I set the timer for 13 minutes. Lori, I've got a surprise for you. I was only half listening, maybe a quarter. I opened the fridge, rooted around for salad fixings. Why don't you guess? I don't know, Mom. What's the surprise? Don't you want to guess? Lighting another cigarette. Residue of the day's lipstick reddening the tip. You went to an audition and got a part in a play? No, I'm afraid my acting days are over. Guess again. Just tell me, Mom. Are you sure you want to know? Of course, I want to know. Darling, I've made up my mind. She paused for effect. I'm moving to Santa Cruz. I wanted you to be the first to know. Blood rushed from my head. I closed the refrigerator, leaned back against the door. Pictures of the kids and little square art magnets clattered to the floor. It's true, years earlier, in a moment of generosity, I had invited Mom to move out to California when she got old. We talked about it once or twice, but I never thought she'd actually take me up on it. It had been 10 years. It finally feels like the right time, Lori. New Jersey just isn't the same anymore. That's right. Your friends are dying off, going into assisted living, or moving to be close to their children. Oh my God, that's me. My hand tightened on the phone. My mother and I had been estranged for years. Yes, we'd forged a shaky peace, but 3,000 miles still separated us for a reason. Our reconciliation only went so far. I love Santa Cruz and I love your family. Wow, Mom, that's amazing. I mean, great. I'm so happy. Well, that's good, darling, because I met with the real estate agent today. I've put my condo on the market. She says it's the perfect time to sell a place at the shore. I collapsed onto one of the red cushy chairs on our yellow formica kitchen table, stared at the black and white checkered linoleum. The floor needed a washing. Lori, are you there? Yeah, Mom, I'm here. You still want me, don't you? Of course, I want you. We all want you. It's just that I never thought you'd actually do it. Well, I'm not getting any younger. She wasn't. Mom was 80 years old and her memory was failing. You don't sound very excited. I am excited. I'm just surprised, that's all. How could I possibly be excited? The woman who'd betrayed me at the worst moment of my life was moving to my town. And I was the one who'd invited her. A beep reverberated in my head and wouldn't stop. Mom was talking about escrow and how hard it was going to be to pack. But I barely heard her. She was the white noise in the background. I was hovering outside my body, listening to just one voice, the one screaming in my head, taking up every inch of bandwidth. I'd finally gotten through cancer, and now this? Why the hell didn't you ask me? How about, Lori, do you remember that conversation we had 10 years ago? I've been thinking about it more seriously and wonder if you think it would be a good idea for you, for me, for us, for Karen and the kids. Or how about, Lori, I know you're getting over cancer. Is this a good time for me to move across the country to live in your town? My friends have told me about this gorgeous mobile home park right at the beach in Santa Cruz, De Anza. Have you heard of it? Yes, Mom. I'll go right from one ocean to the other. So you'll stop by and talk to the manager? Sure. Happy to do that for you. I grabbed a brand new yellow legal pad. It had been months since I'd made a list. What would I have put on it? Take toxic drugs? Throw up? Smoke pot so you could eat? Grow white blood cells? Watch West Wing reruns? Survive? As I wrote, find Mom a place to live, Deanza, on the pristine yellow page, Mom said, gotta run, darling. I promised your Aunt Ruth a call. Click. She hung up on me. The timer was still beeping. I looked into the pot. The spaghetti had congealed into a gelatinous mush. I dumped it in the compost and set a fresh pot of water to boil. As I lifted the heavy pot, I knocked my favorite glass off the counter, and it shattered on the floor. The kids were going to walk in at any moment, and they'd be starving. I swept up the shards and set the table for four, but I couldn't remember which side the fork was supposed to go on.
Wow. Wow. Well, now, so for everybody up, I mean, out there, that this is just the beginning of the book. And that was one of the things that I loved was, is that it isn't just a true story. It is written with such flair that you feel like you're part of it. I mean, literally, you know, I feel like I'm there. I'm in the kitchen. I'm looking at the pasta. You know, and again, having the benefit of having, you know, gone through the book, you know, you and your mother appear to have had many reasons to really never speak to each other. But yet in the book, we see that you try time and time again to rebuild your relationship with each other. Many people would have just given up. Why didn't you?
You know, it's a really good question. And I sometimes describe this, that my mother and I were like two souls who couldn't quit each other, you know. And I think from both of us, even at the time we were the most deeply estranged and not speaking, I felt like she was inside my head and I was listening to her voice every day. So it's like, even in fact, at that point, in some ways, she was more in my head than she was at any other time. And I really longed to reconcile with her, though I never would have admitted it at the time. And I think she felt the same. And even though we had this huge issue between us that seemed completely irreconcilable, we both kept trying to find ways to come back towards each other. And it was a very challenging road, very difficult. It was a lot of trial and error, a lot of failures, a lot of, you know, trying to connect and then retreating back into our corners and licking our wounds. But over the course of years, I think we both took steps to find a way to agree to disagree. And I think this is so relevant for people today, mm-hmm. because yeah. there are so many situations where people have really different belief systems, and there are things that they just cannot get past. And what my mother and I did was, you know, and this happened for me after I had done a lot of healing work. You know, I couldn't have done this immediately. I needed that separation from her to really establish my own autonomy. Mm-hmm. And once I established that, and it really happened around the time I got pregnant with my first child, which was years into this estrangement we had, I think that raised the stakes and made us both want to come towards each other. And we got to the point where we were able to leave this giant unresolved issue sitting there. And we began to weave these little tendrils of connection about the things we could agree on. Like, we liked to cook together. Mm-hmm. We both loved movies. We both loved to go to the theater. My mother was an actor, as you heard in mm-hmm. that piece. And so we would go to the theater together. And we started to focus on things where we could connect,
right.
instead of focusing on the hugest issue that really neither one of us was going to change. You know, I wasn't going to change. She wasn't going to change. I couldn't prove her wrong. She couldn't prove me wrong. And so we gradually started moving back towards each other. Another thing my mother did that I think really made a difference, she was in New Jersey, I was in California. She started, when my son was an infant, and he's now 28 years old, she started coming for a couple of months in the winter. She would leave the cold, snowy New Jersey. She'd rent her own place in California. And she basically put herself in proximity to me so that we could start to build some new experiences. So we didn't just have this painful past. And at first I was not welcoming, the opposite. I was, did not want her to come. But over the years that she did that, which was about a period of 9 years, we gradually began to build some new connections and the triggers were less severe. And we needed to go off and lick our own wounds a lot less. And we started to build what I would consider not really an intimate relationship, but like cordial and caring. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the only thing that made it possible for her to come out at the end of her life and stay for good. And then I faced, you know, can you become a caregiver for someone who betrayed you in the past? That's the story I wanted to tell.
Well, like many good movies, I believe that we have provided a little bit of information that there are people out there now going, I need to know. So can you share with them what the betrayal was?
Yeah, there were actually, I would say, you know, our relationship was problematic, probably from the time I was like maybe a pre-adolescent, because my mother was, she was larger than life. She was like the sun, and she expected me to be this little planet revolving around her and for me to be the kind of daughter she wanted and to fulfill her expectations. And I was another son. I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I was rebellious, and I was a counterculture. I made lots of choices that horrified her, one after another, basically. But it was all about her. So we already had kind of a rocky relationship. Mm-hmm. When I was 23, I came to her and told her I was a lesbian. And she said, you're confirming my worst fear about you. So that's the way, that was sort of where things were. Mm-hmm. And she eventually came around and actually became quite supportive about that. But the biggest rift happened in my late 20s. I began to remember having been sexually abused by my grandfather, who was her father. And when I told her about that, she denied it. She said I was making it up to destroy her. I couldn't have hurt her worse if I'd shot her. And that was really what the final rift between us was, the fact that I said it happened and she said it didn't. And she chose basically her dead father over her living daughter. You know, and then I ended up after that writing my first book, The Courage to Heal, which I wrote with Ellen Bass, which was a guide to healing from child sexual abuse. And so from my family's point of view, not only was I lying, I was now lying on national TV. And that just, you know, my decision to publish that book, I think, was kind of like, that was it. That was the final straw. But we did come back from that, which is kind of remarkable.
It really is. And it's interesting because now with a lot of the division that's just going on in our society, there are things, I mean, far, far less right. important or invasive or however you want to look at it, that people seem to be able to not come back from. And what would you tell some of those people that feel like they have been on whichever end, you know, right. but where they are now so removed from somebody that they just don't feel like they can make the effort?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is you have to look at each individual relationship and decide, is there something worth salvaging? You know, was there something positive to begin with? Is there potential for something positive? And I think there are some circumstances where a relationship is just too toxic and walking away is the wisest, mm-hmm. healthiest choice psychologically or emotionally. But I think in many cases, if you were to make a, you know, two columns about the good in a relationship and the problems, you would probably have a substantial list on both sides. And if that's the case, I think the first thing is you have to give up being right. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you're not, what you're saying isn't true, but you have to give up trying to convince the other person to change their perspective, to change their beliefs, to change their point of view. And, you know, what my mother and I did was we agreed to disagree, and we just stopped talking about this giant elephant in the room. It's not that I backed down. You know, I never recanted. In fact, I had told everyone in the world about my history. But she stopped trying to get me to back down, and I stopped trying to get her to validate my experience. So that was really important. And, you know, I think relationships are a lot more complex than just the single issue that we're pivoting on that might be the reason for the breach. And so, you know, I'm thinking about this woman I interviewed once, and she had come from a very abusive background. Her family, mm-hmm. she was the only person who spoke out. Her family cast her out for decades. And then her parents were getting very old. And mm-hmm. what she did is she said her mother loved the Bible, and she loved this certain psalm. And everyone in that family did like either needlework or embroidery or knitting. And she started to, she bought a sampler that had this psalm that her mother loved. And every night she would sit down, and she would only work on it when she could find a place of feeling loving towards her mother. And she would stitch that love into this sampler. And it took her many months. Wow. And she sent it to her mother as a gift. And her mother framed it and put it on the wall. And very soon after that, she got her first invitation to come to Christmas. In like 30 years. And she thought about it really carefully. She decided to go. And there was that sampler in a very prominent place in the living room. And I just thought that was such a incredible story of someone finding a way around a huge obstacle to connect. And she said that she and her sister, every time she walked into one room, her sister would leave. And so she just planted herself in the living room, took out her embroidery, and just started working on it. And her sister came in, sat on the opposite corner of the room, took out her knitting and started knitting, and looked up at this thing on the wall and said, "That's very nice what you did." And they just started to talk. And by the time I interviewed her, 10 years had gone by, and she had rebuilt her relationship with her sister. And she said she's always careful with her sister because she knew how long they didn't speak to each other. But I just was very touched by that, that there's sometimes like an oblique way, there's another way in that's not just fixated on the issue that you're not going to resolve. So that's my advice to people.
Yeah, and I think that's beautiful. One of the things that I heard you say when you mentioned about relationships and making a list of, in essence, the pros and cons, you know, of this situation. And what it sounds like to me that you did was you made the list and then just said, "I'm going to focus on the pros. I'm just going to focus on that." When you mentioned about, well, we can go to movies, we can do these things. And I love that because I think in so many walks of life, that is what we need to do. Just focus at the right spot. And if we focus on those positives, I think we can probably get through a lot of things.
I mean, that's not going to lead to a particularly intimate relationship. But it might lead to something where, you know, you can spend time and enjoy each other, or, you know, you might be able to go to the same wedding together, or, you know, just get back off from the cliff of absolutes. The other thing that helped me a lot was as I got older, as I became a mother, now I'm a grandmother, I started looking at my mother's life in a different way. And I started seeing all the forces that shaped her, you know, that this grandfather of mine was her father, that she grew up at a certain era where the opportunities for women were not at all, much less than what I was able to access. And I saw that she had actually given me the strength and courage I needed to face what had happened in my childhood. And the ironic thing is she didn't have that same strength and courage, but she was able to kind of like push the next generation up the hill. That's the way I look at it now. So I just started seeing her as more than just my antagonist. and as a human being. And I started seeing myself as more than just either the hero or the victim, and just seeing us as two flawed human beings struggling to try to find a way to have a relationship with each other. And we did, you know, imperfect. It's not like you can't take out the violins at the end and say it was a perfect happy ending. But it, you know, the opposite of estrangement is not always reconciliation. Sometimes it's just peace, you know, coming to terms with what cannot be changed, changing what you can change, and letting go of the war that you're never going to win.
Wow. We are speaking with Laura Davis, and we are talking about reconciliation. We're talking about healing. We're talking about transformation. And we're talking about her new book, The Burning Light of Two Stars. Stay with us. We're going to take a break, but we'll be right back. You're listening to Answers Network.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. We're speaking with Laura Davis, and we are talking about her new book, The Burning Light of Two Stars. One of the questions that I was going to ask, and by the way, if anybody can tell I'm out of breath, I just did it. I ran to take care of something that needed to be taken care of.
Won't ask you what that thing was.
Well, no, actually, no, there was somebody at the door. And they weren't supposed to be here until after 12. So, one of the things that, I was going to say that, you know, at the heart of the story, there's a discovery of a cache of letters. And, you know, it's sort of an intimate, honest, kind of a raw correspondence between you and your mother throughout this time that you weren't speaking to each other. What did you learn from those letters?
Those letters were a really big deal. You know, I know we had corresponded, but I had like shoved the letters in a box for 30 years or 40 years or a long time and just sort of forgotten all about them. And when my mother died, when I was going through her things, I found these giant folders full of letters. And it was all the letters I had ever sent to her. It was copies of all the letters she'd ever sent to me. And it was first drafts, these raw first drafts of letters she had never sent, like the rawest. And I had saved the same. And so after she died, you know, part of my grieving was I pulled out all of my letters and all of hers. I put them together and I forced myself to read them. And what was really challenging was that I had to confront the fact that these habitual stories I had told about my mother and I didn't speak for 7 years. Well, the evidence, these like musty, moldy, old kind of written, you know, you'd open them and they'd break. They were so old. These letters told a different story. And I had to really look at why did I have to tell these stories in which my mother was purely the villain and I was the hero. And there were a lot of letters that were angry or rage filled, but there were also letters that from her that were warm, loving, full of good advice, generous. And I had to see that I had created a story, a storyline to protect myself and to validate my point of view. And so when I went through these letters, I had to really look at what is the truth and what is memory and how we construct our memories. And it's not that the things I said weren't true, but they were just part of the truth. And I think there's a line somewhere in the book where I just said, you know, a truth teller can only tell as much of the truth as she's willing to face at a given time. And that was me. So the journey of reading these letters and going through them and seeing the complexity of the relationship was really shook me to my core. And I think is a really important part of this story. And I just wonder, you know, how many people listening have done the same, where you tell a story and then you tell it over and over and over and over, and it becomes like set in stone. And I saw that I had fixated on my mother's worst qualities, and she had some terrible qualities, but the good qualities, I had just kind of just let them fade away like water. I hadn't held on to them. So I had to create a much more realistic, complex, nuanced picture of who she was and who we were together.
And while you were doing that, what did you learn most about yourself?
That's a really good question. I think most that I had fixated on the negative. There's another scene in the story much later when my mother has moved to California, and we're kind of having, I would call, a second war. You know, we had this first war over the sexual abuse. And then when she was in her 80s, we had this war over her independence. Hmm. You know, I became her caregiver, and, you know, it was like the car keys, whether she could live alone. And I believe she couldn't live alone because she had dementia and it was getting worse. And she believed she had to live alone. And that created a war. And I started keeping a list of all the reasons she couldn't live alone. And I actually was a physical list, and I would sit down and copy it over and like take great pleasure in the evidence against her, you know. And the evidence might be, you know, there's these random pills were on the counter, or she wrote me a check with too many zeros, or, I mean, these are serious things. Sure. But the way I was holding them, I was almost gloating every time I could put something on this list.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say, but it sounds like, but it's going, but it's going back to the point that you made before, where you said you have to get away from this concept of being right, you know. And I think this is what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, I mean, my partner came by, saw what I was doing, and confronted me. And she said, you know, why are you focusing on her worst qualities? Why aren't you building up her strengths? And, you know, at first I was defensive, and then I really thought about it. And I had to look at, in my whole life, I had been building up a litany against her. So that was what I had to learn, was that I had done that. I had a lot of reasons to be very angry at her for many years, but I had held on to those hurts, and I had like polished them. That was the start of me beginning to let go and start to see the relationship in a different perspective, and also start to see my own culpability, that she wasn't the only one who had contributed to the sad state of the relationship that we had.
Well, I think I want to shift a little bit away from as far as just your particular situation and the situation that you were in, which has to do with our Medicare system. I think that there are so many of us now, I know that I'm at that age as well, to where we are either caring for our parents or have recently lost our parents. So in the book, you describe these conflicting feelings about the whole Medicare system and the care that your mother was receiving in the last years of her life. What do you believe are the best healthcare choices that we can make for elderly patients?
You know, I think what I came up against, because I was part of the death of both my parents, is that there's sometimes treatment beyond the point where it makes any sense. And, you know, old age is a terminal condition. And sometimes we don't want to treat it that way. We want to try to fix every single thing. And I know at the end of my mother's life, she would have to go, she had dementia. She didn't understand really what was happening to her. And she had to go to the hospital over and over again because she fell or because this happened or that happened. And I felt like it was torture to put her in that situation. And I think right now there's options of things like palliative care and eventually hospice and ways to make the process of aging and dying much more humane instead of treating it as a medical emergency. So I think that's, and you know, of course it depends what the person wants. And my mother had made it really clear. She used to say, if I ever have to use a walker or wheelchair, just take me out back and shoot me. You know, I knew what she wanted. I was her medical power of attorney. And even that got complicated because as she declined, her standards of what was acceptable as a life started going downhill. So I had to keep adapting to where she was, but I knew that she didn't want to spend her life, you know, with one hospitalization after another, that she said, I want to quit while I'm ahead. And I think, you know, a lot of people feel that way. I think as a caregiver, you have to really know what the person wants because your job is to support what they want. And some people want, you know, treatment at all costs. But I think a lot of older people are going through some very difficult, painful, excruciating treatments, really for no reason, because their family can't let go or their family can't accept the reality that this person is at the end of their life.
Well, we have a question that is coming in. And again, I want to thank those that take the time to send in questions. And oftentimes these are from teachers or people that are working in the middle of the day. And so they'll either send them in earlier in the morning or sometimes even the night before. But this particular one reads, I think that people who have had difficult relationships with their parents, as I did, need to step back and consider what shaped them to behave as they did. I never knew my mother's history until after she passed away. My aunt and I started spending time together, and in small increments, she began telling me about my mother's childhood, the hardships of being the oldest child, helping her mother raise six boys, and my aunt during the Depression. My mother's severe OCD became crystal clear. The more I learned, the more I was able to see her in a totally different light. She developed dementia the last 10 years of her life, and my greatest regret is that she is not here for me to tell her that I now understand, forgive, and how much I love and miss her. Thank you for writing this book. I feel it tells a similar story that so many need to hear, and that is from Janelle.
Thank you, Janelle. Thank you for sharing that story.
Is there anything you want to share with Janelle?
I guess what I want to share is that, yes, we want to try to resolve these things when both people are alive. But, you know, I feel like my relationship with my mother is still alive. The day this book came out, you know, I went to her grave and I had a conversation with her. And you know, what I wanted to tell her is that I remember much more about her than what I was able to record in a single book, and that I wouldn't forget all the rest that I didn't write down. So I think that, and you know, sometimes even if someone is dangerous or really toxic or really difficult, sometimes it's really hard to resolve when they are alive. And much of the resolution happens actually after the person has passed, because there's the safety to kind of unpack the whole situation. And I really understand your regrets that you didn't have that opportunity, but I encourage you to maybe write some letters to your mother now, or in whatever way, you know, with a therapist, or in whatever way to continue to try to resolve the relationship. Even though she can't hear it directly, you know, voice to voice, I believe she'll sense it. And certainly it can bring you much more peace and resolution.
Yeah. And I love that last part, because as you were saying that, that's exactly what I was thinking, which was, you know, doing this is going to help you. You know, that's the key. So I couldn't agree more. Now we have another question now that has come in, and this one reads, I read your first book, Courage to Heal, when it first came out. I could not put it down. Now I can't wait to dive into this latest one. I am looking forward to this interview as I am currently caring for my father in our home after his stroke last spring. It is a hard situation because he has always been a controlling, critical individual to myself and my two sisters. Walking on eggshells was our survival mechanism growing up, and I am finding myself falling back into that pattern. Did you experience anything like this with your mother? And if so, how did you handle the situation? And this is from Gloria in Alabama.
So Gloria, when I was taking care of my mother, I had to get myself back into therapy. That's how I dealt with it. Because what I found was that even though she and I had reconciled to a certain degree before she became old and I became her caregiver, the reality was that the proximity, you know, I had said earlier that we had this 3,000-mile buffer between us. And when I no longer had the buffer, and she was there all the time, it became very difficult. And I also found that her dementia, especially in the early stages, repeated a lot of her worst qualities. You know, she was really anxious. She was explosive. She was unpredictable. She was super emotional and needy. And for me, it was like it put me right back into the worst moments between us from decades earlier. And I found that it was hard for me to separate my current relationship with her from the past. And I did explode a couple of times with her, and I got myself right back into therapy. I needed to have some outside help to separate the past from the present and to navigate being her caregiver. I also joined a support group. The local Alzheimer's Association had a group, and I think these are all over the country, called, and it, you know, you're dealing with a stroke, it's different, but there probably may be something similar, but it was called the Early Stage Memory Loss Support Group. And we would get together once a week. The people with memory loss would go in one room, the caregivers would go in a different room. And I just lived for that group where I got to talk to other people in my same situation. So I think getting support, you know, there was a caregiver resource center in my town, and there might be something similar where you are, but get support and help, because you're dealing with, I mean, taking care of anyone, being a caregiver is really difficult. I mean, it's demanding. In my case, I had two teenage children at home at the same time, so I was like in the sandwich generation. But it's, and if, even if you had a really good relationship, it's still really painful to watch someone decline and grow old. So it's a rough situation regardless. And when you have the kind of unresolved issues that you and I had to deal with, it just makes it much harder. And please don't try to do this alone, and just tough it out. Get some support and help to help you get through it.
And we've got about 5 minutes. What are the things that you miss about her now that she's gone?
Oh, I miss a lot of things about her. In fact, I have a lot of her things in my house, like some of the things from her kitchen. I love being in the kitchen and using things that she had. I have a couple of lamps of hers in my house. I have some artwork. I miss cooking with her. I miss sitting in the theater with her. I even miss some of her really bad habits. I miss some of the things that used to annoy me the most. And I find that my relationship with her has softened so much that I feel very loving towards her. And the things that used to drive me crazy, or her real flaws, they have really receded. And what I feel more appreciative of are the gifts she gave me, because in addition to the challenges, which I turned into gifts, there were actual real gifts, real positive things. So I'm very grateful for those. And I'm also grateful that I broke the cycle, because I have three children. They're either young adults or middle adults, and they're healthier than I was. They don't have trauma in their life. They are solid, you know, in their core. And so I feel like I was able to have the next generation be healthier. So I feel grateful for that. And I feel like in some ways it's because of her and what I had to learn to heal from the relationship that enabled me to change that pattern.
Well, as I mentioned in the very beginning, that you also have workshops that you're doing all over the country and actually all over the world. For those that are listening to this and saying, wow, I want to know more, or I'd love to go to one of the workshops, how can they get in touch with you, or what is the best way for them to get more information?
The best way is through my website, which is lauradavis.net. I've also posted the first five chapters of this book on my site. You could read it for free, which is much more than like the sample on Amazon. So you can really get a sense of it and decide if it's something you want to read. And that's lauradavis.net/chapters. That's lauradavis.net/chapters. My social media is up there too. Facebook is The Writer's Journey. On Instagram, I'm Laura Sari, S-A-R-I, Davis. But all of it is at www.lauradavis.net. I'd love to hear from you.
That's great. And for those of you, if you're driving, we will make sure that information is on our answers.network site. We'll make sure we have all of that information. And again, having about 2 minutes, I love the fact that we started this off by having you read a little bit of the beginning of the book. Is there a little bit you would love to read that would be a beautiful close?
Yes, actually there is. Let me find it. Okay, this is very short.
Okay.
And when my mother read, I wrote another book on reconciliation called I Thought We'd Never Speak Again. And I had my mother read that book because I didn't want the book I wrote to set us back. Mm-hmm. The one thing she asked me for, she said, could you tell more good things about me? And so this is one of those good things.
Okay.
It happened in New Jersey when Mom was still living in my childhood home. I was visiting from far away. I imagined myself in my early 20s. Maybe it was after I left the ashram at 21, when I had no idea what the rest of my life would be. Perhaps it was after I came out to her, when I was on my high horse, spouting feminist philosophy, and she was certain I'd live out my life as a lonely lesbian in a seedy bar. The night before, Mom and I had agreed to call a truce on whatever conflagration was consuming us, and to walk to the beach the next morning. After breakfast, we put on our windbreakers, laced up our sneakers, and headed out the front door toward the Atlantic. The moment we stepped out onto the crooked sidewalk, the sky opened as if God had decided that very day to start the flood. Sunny one moment, a downpour the next. I gasped, she gasped. We were drenched in seconds, rain soaking our clothes, dripping from our noses, saturating our skin, our socks and shoes, soggy white cotton in rubber soles. Mom yelled out, it's raining cats and dogs. I nodded, but could barely hear her. The rain was too loud. We looked at each other, each expecting the other to run back into the shelter of the house. Mom shouted through the rain, let's go anyway. I gaped at her. Did my mother really want to get drenched with me in the rain? As she looked at me expectantly, a huge, adventurous grin spread across her face. I'd never seen that look before. Her hair was stringy and wet, her cheeks painted with rivulets of rain, her dare unmistakable. I wanted to know this woman. Yes, I shouted, grinning back. She put her arm in mine, and it felt like it belonged there. And together we turned away from the known world and the walls of my childhood home and ran out into the soggy streets, our glasses streaked so much we couldn't see.
Thank you. That was beautiful. I could not have thought of a more beautiful way to wrap this up. So, Laura, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on. Thank you for writing the book. Thank you for being so open and vulnerable with the world. And I think you're making a positive difference. And that's all we can ask.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right. For everybody out there, please join us next Monday when we will have Steve Taylor. We'll be talking about his new book, Extraordinary Awakenings, When Trauma Leads to Transformation. So we're going to continue along with this theme. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answers.network. And you can subscribe to the show through Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, and so many others. So pick which platform you like. If they don't have the show, tell them you want this show on that platform. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people, and I want you to know we greatly appreciate it. So for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
Hello, I'm Marty Cove. You might remember me from roles such as Sensei in the Karate Kid films. I've done over 100 films and countless stunts in my career, and I've always given 100%. With the damage done to my body over time, I needed to find relief from my chronic pain. My passion for health and fitness drove me to find a natural way to combat muscle pain. Teaming up with doctors, detectives, and a compounding pharmacist, we've created Marty's Cobra Cove Ultra Strength CBD Cream. It's the only thing that has been strong enough to knock out my pain, and fast. Honestly, you may have tried the rest, but it's time to try the best. It's legal, it's safe, and 100% effective. Show your pain no mercy. Go to www.martyscobracove.com.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.